Hello and welcome to Blue Rose Cinema Club. I am Crash and Burn.
And I'm Charlie.
And today we're talking about Yeah, it's a little Chasing Amy.
Miramax Films presents a comedy that tells it like it feels.
She's been around and seen things we've only read about in books.
So what'd you do last night?
Got lucky.
Chasing Amy.
Yeah, I mean, shit, let's just dive into the weirdest inclusion in the Criterion Collection.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's a odd choice. I understand why, especially when it was released in the Criterion Channel. Like, it came out in Laserdisc first, not Laserdick.
Laserdick.
Came out on Laserdisc first and then got ported to DVD. It was, at the time, seemingly the start of a promising indie career. Kevin Smith was getting a lot of praise. He was seen as this face of the new wave of indie cinema, which today, 24 years later, seems laughable, but no offense, Kevin. I do still love Kevin Smith, the guy, if not maybe his work, but
yeah,
it's weird now today to look back and say, like, oh yeah, this guy was considered, the dude who made Yoga Hosers was considered a face of the new wave of indie cinema.
Yeah, the guy who did some late episodes of Flash that were all right was once going to be the new Quentin Tarantino, just as Quentin Tarantino was still a thing.
Yeah. This is the first time I rewatched it yesterday. It's the first time I've seen it since probably the early 2000s. It hasn't aged super well. There's a lot that has dated the fuck out of the film.
Let's just get to
where it. Do you want to start?
let's do the details. So, 1997 rom-com, directed and written, of course, by Kevin Smith, and produced by View Askew Productions, distributed by Miramax.
Yeah, most people kind of point to Chasing Amy as the one where, like, oh, they've gotten it. And they also point, but at the same time, Chasing Amy, as much as Chasing Amy is used to praise me, it's also used to, like, cut me down, because people be like, he hasn't made a good movie since Chasing Amy. I'm like, when you hear that, you're like, fuck, man, that makes me not like Chasing Amy now, because that's the last time this clown thought I was good. But then it passes very quickly, because I'm like, hey, man, at least they liked one of them.
Well, and it was made for a really low budget, because Smith had made Clerks, that was super successful. He had made Mallrats, which was not. And this was supposed to be his next kind of trying to be more serious, trying to grow as a filmmaker. And he wrote the script for, as he always does, actors he's known and worked with and are friends with.
Yeah.
And he pitched the studio, said, I want to do this. They said no. They came back with a ridiculous cast list that I'm pretty sure was Drew Barrymore, John Stewart, and David Swimmer were supposed to play the three leads, which I think would be a way to make this film worse.
Yeah.
And problems aside, all of the actors in this film do really fantastic work.
Yeah, like, everyone does great. So, like, that's Ben Affleck as Holden McNeil, Joey Lauren Adams as Alyssa Jones, Jason Lee as Banky Edwards, Dwight Yule as Hooper or Hooper X. The best character in the entire film. And, of course, Jason Mewes and Kevin Smith as Jay and Silent Bob.
Holy fucking shit. Finger cuffs? You're dating finger cuffs, you silly son of a bitch? Wait a sec, I thought she was all gay and shit.
She was. She is. I don't know.
To his credit, the film looks better than 250,000. It was shot on film. It doesn't look great, and there are some bafflingly weird camera placement choices, but it does look, it's one of his better looking films, I would say.
It's definitely one of his better looking films. It's one of his more controlled and subdued films. He made that $250,000 work. The cast is fantastic. The shooting is decent, but very specifically, it also has a fantastic and recognizable score. I believe by Soul Asylum. It's like this film could have just fundamentally cost at least twice as much, if not four times the amount. Like this film shouldn't exist for the amount it was, and it has to be his greatest financial success at $20 million.
Like, it's the reason he got he had a pretty solid career after this, and he got to do Dogma directly after.
Which is, yeah, that
had its own problems.
Has its own problems. Is infinitely more watchable and entertaining.
And it has at least a third less grotesque gay bashing.
Yes, maybe a third, as much as a third. The film is based partially on a scene from 1994's Go Fish by Guinevere Turner about selling out sexually, and Smith's own feelings of inferiority during his then-ongoing relationship with Joey Lauren Adams. So, as you said, he wrote for his friends. And at the time, his friends were mostly Ben Affleck, Jason Mewes, and Adams, who he was sleeping with. So you end up with a film where he just subs in Jason Lee, who he already worked with, and you get the movie as it is. It's weird. I want to say, like, up front, this feels like reading a copy of Wizard magazine back in the late 90s. Like, this film perfectly encapsulates what comic book culture felt like in the 90s.
It's a very viscerally nostalgic in both good and bad ways. Like, it reminds you of the tone and atmosphere in comics back then, where, you know, a lot of straight white dudes thought they were a persecuted minority.
And it's funny because, like, today, you know, like, they complain often because they are, you know, facing, like, characters are being created for other audiences and they're not being listened to as much. At the time, they were the kind of only audience. They were the vast majority of the audience, that is, and they still complained about the same old shit. So it just kind of goes to tell you that it's all bullshit.
They've got one note and they play the fuck out of it.
Yeah, they do.
Cooper, how come you sound like Minister Farrakhan when you're on stage and the King of Pop when you're not?
Look out, boys, this kitten has a whip!
Before I get to speak, you dick! Oh, I swear! Jesus, the next con I attend and they ask me to be in the minority panel, if I see your name anywhere near that list, I'm passing.
Hold on, Banky. This pile of PMS is Alyssa Jones. She does that book Idiosyncratic Routine.
Oh, I've read your book. It's cute. Chick stuff, but cute. What?
Sorry about him. He's dealing with being an anchor.
Oh, you trace.
This film, on the surface, is about queer relationships, queer themes, queer characters, but really, I think the backlash that has occurred to this film over the last decade has come from this. People have grown to understand that it's not about any of that. It's about a straight, white, heterosexual, like the cis hetman, coming to terms with the existence of queer people.
Him dealing with the fact that people other than his worldview exists.
Yeah.
And it's quite honestly reacting pretty badly to it. Like, if he's supposed to be the Ben Affleck character as a author insert, then that's a horrible reaction to it.
Right. It's, of course, about Holden and Banky. They are comic book creators. They came up with Blunt Man and Chronic, which is a brilliant satire of Jay and Silent Bob as a weed dealing and empowered Batman and Robin. And at one of the cons and then the after party to the con that night, Holden meets Alyssa Jones, who is also a comic book writer / animator for a couple of lesbian romance titles. And he falls for her stupidly hard before finding out that, oh, the writer of those lesbian romance titles is gay.
It's a really, really cringe-worthy scene of when he finds out of going to meet her at the club. She sings a song that he thinks is dedicated to her, but it's actually the woman standing next to him. She gets off stage and kisses her, and Ben Affleck's reaction is awkward and bad, but it's Jason Lee's
very nice.
Like, minutes long, looking around, seeing multiple women make out. Oh! Oh! this is a gay bar. It's so kind of hammy and over the top that I think it works, if not cringy.
I mean, that's the thing. So yeah, Jason Lee's character Banky is very homophobic, very, very, very
aggressively so.
But he's also in that exact way that a lot of people who would consider themselves progressive in the 90s thought as well. So, like, when he realizes he's in a gay bar, he doesn't have this visceral reaction and aggressive anger and hate. He starts asking those really kind of, you know, immature questions instead. Because that's where his head goes. It's the same as Jason Lee's other character, who is not related whatsoever to this character that exists in the same universe, from the previous film, Mallrats, who confronted with Stan Lee and having the ability to ask him any question about the industry whatsoever, proceeds to ask about the thing's dick, because that is the immature level that Jason Lee can play at. His characters are at, and quite frankly, Kevin Smith, certainly in the 90s.
Writing stylist. Yeah. Like, it's definitely it's an immature writer trying to sound profound. That's what it really felt like to me. Is like, this is someone who's like, oh, I'm actually tapping into something bigger and more powerful. This isn't just dick and fart jokes like my last film. I'm actually trying to tap into something real. But it's a very shallow and surface level understanding of that, and it's there, but it's rough.
I
also, you said about kind of a Jason Lee's character is a progressive view of, in the age of someone of that gay bashing mindset. Spoilers, it turns out towards the end of the film that he is gay, or at the very least bi by the end of the film.
Yeah.
Which kind of plays into the rather insidious trope of all homophobes are secretly gay, which is not a great thing to be putting out there.
No. And at the very least, there's his character development to that point. You can see it. Luckily, it doesn't just kind of like slam home as kind of a joke or something. There is an evolution there, and there's an inciting incident where a very dumb decision is made. That kind of seems to be the kind of work someone would put into avoiding accepting something about themselves. He's really fascinating as a throwback, and he's representative of the shallowness of this film. It's really fascinating that the most important character and relationship in this movie, to understand this movie, isn't Holden and Alyssa. It's Banky and himself. And his own realizations and the depth of his identity, because the depth of his straight identity going into this film is essentially gawking at lesbians, and the depth of his gay identity leaving this film is almost like a jealousy or some strange obsession with owning and possessing Holden. So
yeah.
we're not anywhere good, but we have had some sort of progress. And that really exemplifies this film, because Smith at the end of the film hasn't learned anything to become a better person. Like, it's not until the Jay and Silent Bob reboot that there's a good conclusion to this story in which those involved become fucking adults. And he realizes that maybe he was a dumb shit when he made it.
Watched Patrick Williams' video on Kevin Smith and as a whole a few days ago, and he brings it up a good point. Like, yes, now this is objectively bad, a terrible representation. It doesn't fit at all for addressing the political issues it's talking about. At the time, while it still wasn't great, it was better than a lot of what was out there, especially by straight male filmmakers. Which is not giving it a pass or an excuse. It is saying that, well, I think he failed at what he was trying to do. It was at least admirable that the attempt was made there as blindly as it was made.
Yeah, exactly. Like, an attempt was made, and he reached out, and he did, for a time, achieve something. I mean, I can't ignore this film. Personally, it was really important for me and my identity growing up. But it's still a bad film. Structure-wise, it's a mess. Filming-wise, it's a mess. It's very young. He's not interested in learning necessarily. At some point, he got into his head that he's going to be part of this great new generation of directors, and therefore, I don't need to go and learn more about filming. You're here for my voice, and it's like, your voice could use work.
Yeah, it's, and I think there is a point in his career when you can see, like, Clerks 2 is kind of really when he's like, I'm gonna stop growing. Or I guess he tried Red State after that, which also...
He had ideas?
Had ideas. He tried. The important thing is he tried.
Yeah.
But it really now is, and again, this is way harsher on Smith than I intended, because I do like the guy, and I like what he's trying to do, and if I could live like him and just do podcasts with my friends and not have to worry about film and just hang out and smoke weed and talk movies, like, it would be hard to say no. That would be a very hard career path to turn down.
Yeah. I can definitely understand turning that instead of becoming the weird, like, nitrate obsessed recluse that Quentin Tarantino has become, where every single moment of his day is trying to make sure that my next movie has to be perfectly new and original and something I've never done before. And that sounds incredibly exhausting. The decades that he puts into each film pays off, but I completely understand Smith's approach too, of like, or fuck it.
Yeah, I have a wife and daughter. I can just live comfortably. Every now and then make a cheap little movie that I write the first draft while stoned. I don't edit it ever again. We just shoot the first draft. I edit it while we're shooting, and it's done. Yeah. And I have a great time, and my fans like it, and that's all that matters. I'm like,
yeah. I don't even bother.
I'm glad you're content, man.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, like, you know, at the same time, I feel like this film will not get to enjoy any of that because it's not fun. And so now he's so dedicated to, like, having fun with films and such that, like this, the only mention this film got, aside from being the basis for both Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back and Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, both of which are about making movie versions of Bluntman and Chronic. Mm-hmm. So this film is his actual foundational, fundamental to the View Askewniverse work, and yet it's the most ignored, aside from 5 minutes at the end of Reboot when you find out that Holden and Alyssa had a daughter together via Holden, like, donating sperm, and it's finally they are acting like adults. Finally, they're kind of written a little better, because I get the feeling Ben Affleck took his lines and went,
I can do better.
Yeah. Let me handle it, Kevin. I'll write my scene. Because it suddenly abruptly shifts into, like, the lessons learned by an adult parent.
Yeah. I wasn't a big fan of Reboot, but that scene is fantastic. The majority of Reboot to me was just, it felt sad. It was like, the entire movie felt like the joke from Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where it's, hey kids, Mark Hamill, applaud. Yeah. The whole movie was, hey kids, Jay and Bob.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember this line from the last film? We're going to say it again.
Here's a celebrity he knows. Here's an old celebrity he knows. Ooh, here's a new celebrity he met who always wanted to be in his films when they were growing up. Look, kids, it's Chris Hemsworth. You know, and,
yeah, I don't know how the hell he got Hemsworth. I'm sure he must have. It must have met him at some Marvel promotion, because Smith does so many of talks about comics and hosting. They must have met. Smith, by all accounts, seems like a genuinely nice guy, friendly, gets along with everyone. Like, there's a reason one of the things he will be best known for is an evening with Kevin Smith, his lecture tours, because he is fantastic at that. He's a great storyteller, he's engaging. And I'm sure if you met him in person, you instantly feel the same. So anyone he's met would be like, yeah, I'll show up for a day. You get half a day.
Right.
Which is why so many of those cameos really feel like they were shot in the corner of someone's, like, dressing room. This movie does end very bizarrely. Like, it cuts to, they have their big blowout, they separate, which would be a sad but fitting ending to end it where it did. And then there's a 1 year later coda that is well acted, but I watched it twice. I don't know what they're trying to say with it. Like, it's he reconnects with Jason Lee all wordlessly just through looks, and it's like, okay, that's nice. I'm glad they're friends again, but they're clearly not addressing all of the things they need to address to be friends again.
Right.
And he runs into Alyssa, gives her the comic that's like, yeah, hey, I was an asshole. Here's a comic that you can read where I'm sorry. And that's it. She's like, okay, thanks, I'll read it.
Yeah.
He walks away and is like, yeah, someone I used to know. And there's this sad, kind of melancholy pullback where they show the convention. And it's just bizarre how it ends. It really feels like it is trying to tell a bigger message than is actually there.
I agree. And I think that, once again, it's timing and its age. It used to have something to say. Like, that used to feel much more powerful. Even if you think about it and you go, well, no, there was nothing there. It just, watching it, you're like, no, this used to mean something. This used to have a power, and now it's been completely robbed of it, or it's just bled off over time.
Yeah, it is trying to address with, at the time, current sexual politics. So, of course, those age the worst out of anything in films, but it really...
Yeah, and
it's gone so far, I don't know what it was trying to say back then, even.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And yeah, I guess all it was really trying to say back then, even, was that Smith was trying to understand his own hang-ups. And that's as far as there actually is to this movie. For context, for anyone watching who might be too young, this came out, I believe, the same year that Ellen DeGeneres came out gay and was, like, the only big out person in, like, celebrity. So
it was a huge deal when she came out. Like, there was...
It was on Time magazine.
Yeah. People lost their shit.
Yeah. Now who gives a fuck?
Susan, I'm gay.
But anyway, there's two fun quirks of this film in terms of, like, production in other media. The first we've touched on before. So this film didn't go to VHS. It didn't go to DVD. It went to Laserdisc. And not only Laserdisc, the first pressing of this film after it was done in theaters was directly to the Criterion Collection.
Yeah, it is spy number 75. Like, this is in the first 100.
Yeah, this film is so in there. They can never remove it for fear of shame and some Jenga level collapse of the entire system afterwards. We got to stick our hands on this.
I do not doubt, I highly doubt it will get the special Blu-ray re-release of Criterion, though. I think DVD is as far as it's going to go.
I believe that it did get a Blu-ray release, but that was unrelated to Criterion. That was Kevin Smith and View Askew coming up with their own, like, special DVD holy shit package.
Yeah.
I can't see this one ever coming out again, except with a big fat cultural essay attached to it on why it is wrong. And
it's did it come? No, it didn't. They used to come with booklets. I was wondering if the DVD did.
Mine comes with a lovely booklet with
art
by, I can't remember. He's the same guy who did Madman, the comic.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it's this really lovely detailed. There's an introduction, an essay describing where it came from. There's this fantastic kind of map / booklet.
Cool.
Thing.
I'm pretty sure I got this from a secondhand Blockbuster, so I do not have the booklet.
I know for a fact that I got secondhand because it still has the $8.99 tag on it, but this came from a private DVD store where, like, they only sell nerdy Criterion and stuff and whatever. The other weird thing about the release of this is it's seen two comic releases somewhat. There was scenes from it adapted for various Clerks comics, such as Smith and Mahfood's Clerks. But there's also a fantastically, and by fantastic I mean terrifyingly graphic manga prose book in Japan, apparently, where half of it's written out like a novel, and the sexual stories and events are all very much shown.
Good lord.
Yeah, and apparently, like, he didn't write it. The rights to the movie got optioned off, but apparently it was very successful in Japan.
That is wild. I would like to read that, and also I never want to. I'm completely split. I'm curious, and that sounds horrifying.
Right, and from what I understand, it was never translated from Japanese to English, so any copy you get would have to be, like, probably force-fed through an app, and you're going to have a wonderful, wonderful translation out of that.
I think I'm just going to be happy, like, just imagining it exists. That's the distance I want. I'm willing to travel for that.
It's probably for the best.
Smith also, kudos to him for his monologue in the middle. He delivers it really well. It's, as he always does, he plays Silent Bob in these films and has his one scene where he shows up. He gets to have a nice, well-acted and well-delivered monologue. Probably one of the better performances he's done.
Yeah, no,
it actually seems
it's funny how the Chasing Amy section itself, that scene, it still holds up, completely separate from the film. The narrative that he describes, it's still fantastic for describing, like, the mindset of a young heterosexual man who was probably a little intimidated by experiences of other people.
Yeah, and, like, especially bringing in his, like, deeply religious Catholic background and all of that compared to, like, it is interesting seeing him work through his insecurities. I don't think he takes the correct lessons, or at least he didn't when he made this. He seems better now, but Joey Lorraine Adams' character, her entire role there is just to make Holden feel better. Like, the ending, we don't get any closure for her. We don't really see the troubles she's going through with all of this. It's just she has to teach Holden that gay people exist.
Yeah, yeah. The entire film, everything, all the characters, the plot and all that, it serves purely to give Holden a hand-holding lesson towards, you know, being a better person. She has no validity herself, except as an instrument for his education and for mockery. So, like, the queer themes aside, the gay bashing aside, you still have a lot of, like, really bad sexual harassment and abuse in this. Like, the finger cup thing seems funny in the 90s and then become really, really bad.
It's just awful.
Yeah.
It's assault. There's no real other way to describe that scene as they describe it in the show.
Yeah.
And it's, like, played off as, like, isn't this a quirky backstory that she was assaulted and then just kind of went along with it?
Yeah, and is now the mocked for it. And so it's like, oh, okay, so that whole thing just happens and there's no catharsis from it. We just move on because it's not meant to be cathartic or give us any information about the character. It's purely, ha, that's funny. Funny.
And there's an amazing scene about midway through the film when Holden confesses his love to her completely out of the blue, just blindsides her with it, with her, like, this person that, from her point of view, is becoming a good friend, and he betrays all of that and says, I love you and I can't put up with this anymore. And she, understandably, gets out of the car, flips out on him, and walks away in the rain. And he chases after her. It's a really impressive long take of the camera's on dolly going along the side. You only see the camera crew in windows like three times. It's quite impressive. And she just says, you know, what the fuck? Like, this isn't fair. You are dumping all this on me, and you are not even considering my point of view or my perspective at all. And it's a fantastic scene. And she leaves, and it should end there. Unfortunately, the film does not end there. He walks back to the car, and she comes back and kisses him, and then they're dating now. So it feels like, hey, we've gotten to the root of the issue. Like, we need to address her as a character. We need to actually understand her perspective and worldview of this. And they mention it, and then it's just never brought up again until the end. Like, it's just completely like, oh, well, she mentioned this is a problem, but I guess it's not.
Yeah, the third act is kind of an opposite of a Deus Ex Machina, where, like, you expect something to come in, and instead something just, like, leaves. And so the movie ends. Oh.
Yeah.
We're not going to deal with that? So we're done here. Okay, then.
So we're... And if it was a choice to just leave it hanging, I think that would be actually a strong ending, to just say sometimes things don't get resolved. Like, emotional issues are hard and messy.
Yeah.
That could have been a solid ending. But the ending that is on the film is shot and edited in a way to convey that they've moved on, grown, and learned from this. But it feels like the film's hoping that you, the audience, have figured out what they've learned from it, because it's not going to say, because I don't think it actually knows.
Yeah, it just knows. It's a term that I'm starting to use quite a bit, because you start seeing it where directors get lazy. It's cargo cult cinema.
Who was that?
Oh, just some guy I knew.
Does it mean anything? No, but it looks like it does. And that's all that matters.
Feels like it's important.
Yeah, and it's cargo cult cinema.
I understand why it was included, and I don't necessarily think it's a wrong inclusion, but I think it definitely needs a lot more footnotes and asterisks added of why it was important at the time, and is now mainly important as just a relic of a different era of cinema that did not go the way that anyone expected it to.
No, it did not. Well, I guess that wraps it up for today's episode of the Blue Rose Cinema Club. Thank you so much for joining us, listening, watching in. Please.
Thank you so much.
Yes, my God, yes. Please like, share, and subscribe. Select the bell to get more, if there is a bell. Leave us a comment so that we know what we're doing right, we know what we're doing wrong, and to drive that traffic up. Charlie, is there
anything? We'd love to. Leave a comment, please. If you want to send us an email with questions, comments, if you think we're right, if you think we're wrong, if you think we're stupid, email away, please. If you have any questions, or if you feel that we didn't cover something that should have, let us know, and we will try to address that in a future episode. The email will be here.
It's right there. And of course, I will put that in the show description for anyone who is on the podcast and cannot see with your ears.